In the Wild West world of podcasting, there is one podcast that is authentic and genuine and continues to stand tall in its originality. Based on a passion for his guests, their work, and his love of podcasting, Derek Thomas and Monday Morning Critic Podcast get amazing, diverse, unique guests found nowhere else. The variety and quality are endless. There is something for everyone. Derek Thomas is the hero you deserve. He's a silent guardian, a watchful protector. Welcome to Monday Morning Critic Podcast. Here is Derek Thomas.
Johnny Lawrence, I knew it was you. Holy, how the hell are you?
Hey, man.
Oh, my God, look at you. You still got those golden locks, eh? God, this is crazy. How you been?
Great, man, thanks. I've been great.
That's great. Hey, Anoush, come here. Louie, get over here. I want you to meet somebody.
I gotta go.
No. This is Johnny Lawrence. He and I go way back, right, buddy? This guy was the toughest dude in my high school. When I first moved here from Jersey, we got into it a little bit. This guy really had it in for me.
Yeah, well, you did move in on my girl.
Well, she actually wasn't really a girl anymore, was she? I mean... all right, it's all water under the bridge.
Wait, is this the karate guy? The guy from the tournament?
Oh, this is the guy whose ass she kicked.
Listen, it was a really close match, but if you want to get technical, I kicked his face. I'm just busting your chops.
It was an illegal kick.
Oh, illegal? Really? Come on, what about that elbow to my knee?
Yeah, I got a warning, you got the win.
Whoa. No fighting in the showroom, guys.
Yeah, come on. All right, back to work.
All right, nice meeting you.
Hi, this is Dan Adute, and you are listening to the Monday Morning Critic Podcast.
That's okay. So I'm going to say Ralph Macchio has, I think it's 2 million followers on Instagram. He follows 55 people. You are one of those 55.
Wow, what is I didn't it, know that.
What is it that you think that is, you know, so solid about your rapport that the two of you guys have? What is it you think? I've heard you on other interviews say, you know, you guys get together for lunch and you're talking, he's a big wine guy. But, like, what is it about your rapport that makes it so strong, Dan?
Well, that's very nice to say. I love that guy. First of all, it's funny. Whenever people ask me about the show, the first thing they ask is Ralph Macchio nice? And he's... Or are Ralph and Billy nice? Yeah. And they're like the nicest guys ever. I think they're like super humble about this opportunity they've been given. They're so just nice and fun on stage. And I think the reason Ralph and I get along is because I feel like when Brett and I are on set, Brett plays Cousin Louie.
Right.
You know, we are both comics and we just bust everyone's balls and we're just being funny a lot of the time. And you know, for all intents and purposes, it's a pretty dramatic show. So they get to have like a fun, like comic relief. So they enjoy that. But he and I get along really well just based off of food stuff, food and drinking and wine. And that's honestly, so I'm like awful at talking to famous people. I'm not good at it at all. Like I always clam up. I don't know what to say to them. And so for me, I've always loved food and I've used that as my way to bond, like my way in. And I did it with Ralph and it, you know, we just started getting along really well. And we're also both from Long Island, so we know all the same places. And I don't know. I mean, it's funny because that was like the impetus for why I started my podcast, which is just interviewing celebrities based on food, because that's like the only way that I can talk to them.
Yeah. Yeah. I love your podcast. We're going to get to that, too. Two things off of what you just said. You have a great line in your stand-up routine where you say, explain foodies to somebody from a third world country.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I love being a foodie, but I do hate the word foodie. It's just like so pretentious. And so I'd have this thing of like, just imagine if you want to see how pretentious the word foodie is, try explaining it to someone from a third world country. You'd be like, oh, I'm a foodie. I really, really, really like food. And then the third world country guy's like, oh, I also really, really like food. I'm also a foodie. So, yeah, it's just adding a little dash of perspective.
And the other thing I wanted to add is that I'm convinced that William and Ralph are vampires because they haven't aged a day since 1984. Like, yeah. I mean, one guy's like 61, one guy's like late 50s. It's like, are you kidding me? These guys could pass for 30 or maybe younger. Like, I'm convinced that they're vampires. By I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong with that.
It's very, very strange. I'm trying to find whoever their vampire plastic surgeon is to do whatever they do.
Oh, man. I wanted to ask you about, because you have a great story here. Your parents escape Iran, right? So in a way, it's, you know, you're a really academic, accomplished guy. Johns Hopkins, super bright. You know, mom and dad's story alone is just a beautiful one. You go to Johns Hopkins and then kind of take a quick, sharp U-turn. Dan, I know you've told the story many times, but it's worth repeating however you want to say it. But you decide that maybe Johns Hopkins is not maybe the path that you want, right?
Yeah, I went to Hopkins. I graduated with honors, did well on my MCATs, got into medical school, and then decided it was time to give my parents a heart attack and became a comedian. I mean, look, I was good at medicine. I was good at science, but like, I was so passionate about making people laugh. Like, it was the only thing that gave me like true joy. And I still remember when I got my acceptance letter to medical school, I like had a nervous breakdown. Like, I was like in the fetal position in my bed, and my mom was like, "What's wrong with you?" I was like, "I got accepted into med school." Like, isn't this what you dreamed of? And I was like, "No, this is what you dreamed of." You know, I took, I was like, give me one. I told my parents, I was like, let me take 1 year after college and try this comedy thing. And then I'll go back to med school right after. And that 1 year has expanded to about 20 years now. And, I think, it was like in my bones, like I felt like I can't do this and I need to do comedy, which is funny to me because like, especially now that you live in LA, like there's so many actors that you meet who are just like, I tried acting and now I'm just like thinking of trying stand up. What do you think? And I'm like, if you don't feel it in your bones every morning of like waking up, like I need to do this, then don't do it. Like, cause it's the worst thing ever. It's the most rejection. You're putting yourself in such an awful, awful position mentally.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you can survive it, amazing. But like, the barrier for entry is so high, and it's just like unless everyone tells you no, don't do it, and you still want to do it, then you shouldn't do it.
Not to mention, Dan, stand-up comedy is the most difficult thing anybody can do. Like, either you're funny or you're not. Like, I mean, it's just that simple. I mean, you have to, and like you said, if you don't have that drive, it's game over, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's kind of what's savage about it, and also what's beautiful about it. Like, to me, it's like the most beautiful art form that there is, right? Because there's no backup dancers, there's no band, there's no backup singers, like there's no instrument. Like, it's literally you and your voice and a light. And it's just like, there's nothing more pure of an art form, in my opinion. And I just like, when it works, it's like, it's a superpower, you know?
Yeah. So, and you came, you say that you came, you know, to the realization, you know, that, listen, I'm not going to go down this medical school path. I mean, you already came a long way as it is. But I'm wondering why it took Ken Jeong that much longer to realize, right? Because he became a doctor. Because I was thinking about his life and I was thinking about your life. I'm like, Jesus, they're pretty damn similar, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess he just followed through with the med school part of it.
Yeah.
He went a little too far. I mean, you know, it's funny. It's a weird career because, like, stand-up is so much like everything is in your control and you are in control of everything and you can't blame anyone else. And then you get into acting where you're just at the mercy of a machine and you have zero control over anything.
Right, right.
And I remember I moved to LA after about 10 years of doing stand-up, and ultimately, I got onto the CBS show. It was a pilot that I auditioned for. I got into the pilot. The pilot got picked up. We filmed 8 episodes. It was called Friend Me. And after the 8th episode, the showrunner committed suicide.
Mm.
And the whole show basically just got ended.
Mm.
And it was like, it was really awful on so many accounts. Like, you know, the guy was such a nice guy, and it was just really heartbreaking for everyone.
Right.
But it was also this moment of like, I need to get a little bit of control back into my career because I need to, I mean, it's going to sound a little cruel, but I was like, I need to do things where my suicide is the only thing that'll affect
whether
it works or not. So I started to write. I started writing then. And I started writing my own stuff. And I basically got into like selling TV shows and developing shows and, you know, doing punch up. And so I think now I've kind of carved out this nice little middle ground of like, you know, I've got the stand-up career, the writing, you know, I do the acting, which is fun, but it's not like my life depends on it. Because that's just a dangerous place to be, man. Acting is like such a crapshoot.
Right.
Like people who are just actors, I give them all the credit in the world because I don't have the balls to do that.
Well, you're a man of many talents, right? Like you just said, for those listening, you know, writer, actor, comedian. Do you find, Dan, that, I mean, you've been on, we're going to get to the Tonight Show in a second, but you've been doing all these things for a long time. Do you find that cancel culture or people attacking comedians on stage has thrown another wrench into things? Because, I mean, it's gone to a place where it's just flat out goofy, right? Because people go to stand-up shows to forget about the real world. Because that is what makes things fun. I mean, you've written roasts. We'll get to that in a second. Like, that's why people love comedy, because it's stuff that you normally wouldn't hear in an everyday situation, right? It's like people have lost their minds in some ways, Dan. I'm not saying some of it's not warranted, but Jesus Christ, if people can't go up there and be funny and do your thing, like, Dan, I was listening to some of your stand-ups. They're really original and really great. Like, for somebody to censor or limit that, like, cut the shit. Like, that's terrible.
Yeah, it's super unfortunate, and I hate being one of those stand-ups who's like getting on a soapbox and being like, we are the culture warriors. Cause it's like, you know, there's actual soldiers out there who are fighting wars, but like,
right.
But we are somewhat on the front lines of this.
Of course.
You know, because the job of a stand-up comic, especially, is to find where the line is, and you don't find where the line is until you go over it a little bit and then you course correct. And yes, it's when people are preemptively, you know, they're just like shooting their camera of you doing your set, hoping you fuck up so that they can post it. Yeah, it's a dangerous place to be, which is like, it's funny. I did a lot of college shows back in the day, and I just reached out to my agent. And I was like, let's try this again. You know, let's try to get back into it, because, you know, a lot of college kids watch Cobra Kai. And she's like, okay, cool. And I sent her a set, and she's been my agent for 20 years. I sent her a set, and she's like, whoa, you got it. Like that bit about the third world country foodie. She's like, you can't do that. You can't do anything that is remotely edgy. And it's like, why are we putting these kid gloves on to do stand-up comedy? Like, that's the fun of it. It's like bungee jumping for your mind, right? Like it's like you're like going to places that you wouldn't normally go to.
Yeah.
And, you know, and coming out of it alive. Like, to me, it's exhilarating as an audience member.
Right.
So why would you want to rob that? And even if you disagree or you feel attacked, or don't take it so personally, man. Like, it's all part of the thing. It's all part of the game. I mean, look, I remember I did this bit once, and I think something about Parkinson's disease, and someone was like, my grandmother has Parkinson's disease. I was like, so does mine, so does everyone's. Like, like, that's, why are you making this so much about yourself? Like, I have an older brother who passed away from cancer, and every time I hear cancer, I think about that. But has that ever once made me be on a show and say, oh, you can't use this line because it reminds me of my brother? No, it's like you brush it off and you move on. Like, it's, and if people lose that muscle of being able to just brush something off, that I feel bad for them, man, because then it's like your immune system, your like emotional immune system to like just be able to weather something that some sort of you know, emotional disaster is like so weak. Like,
that is so well said. You know, and life is tough enough, right? And comedians provide that levity. You know, that's kind of why, Dan, I love listening to or watching Ricky Gervais, whether he's hosting the Golden Globes or he's doing his stand-up. Have you ever seen the end of the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? I don't know if you're, so Leo at the end takes this blowtorch to the people that are attacking his house and just gets it. And I feel like when I watch Ricky Gervais, he's the verbal version of that. He just takes a blowtorch and just gets and, but that's why I love stand-up comedians, because they don't give an F. Like, and that's what I love. Like, I'm not saying go out and purposely hurt people without having a tasteful and crafty act. I'm just saying that's why people pay the money to go to stand-up shows, because they want to see that. They want to laugh. They want to see. I don't know. Is that kind of a decent take, Dan, that I'm bringing up?
It's a decent take. I'll tell you the sad thing, though. The sad thing is that all these people who can really, really speak their mind, like Ricky Gervais and like Chappelle and, you know, even Louis C.K., they're fucking billionaires.
Yeah. So
you have to be insulated with so much money to be able to speak freely, which is so sad. You know what I mean? So that's like, that's kind of the dirty truth of that. It's like, yes, Ricky Gervais is awesome, and it's awesome that he can say what he says, but he's getting $1 million in residual checks off of The Office every month or every week, probably. So you know what I mean? The stakes are so low for him. I feel way worse for the open mic comic who has a really hot take on something and feels like they have to self-censor because they don't want their career to end before it's even begun.
The risk is significantly greater for somebody that doesn't have that security of that much money. That's such a good point, Dan. I never even thought about that. Right?
It's sad. Because it used to be, it didn't matter. It was a free-for-all. Like, anyone could say whatever they wanted. And, you know, the only thing that filtered was, is it funny or not? You know, I also, like, I don't know. I feel like people's obsession with, like, punching up and punching down and punching. I'm like, if it's funny, it's funny. Like, I don't care what your status is. You know, versus me, if you're making fun of me and it's funny, and if you're a higher status, like, I don't give a fuck. Like, if you got the laugh, you got the laugh.
Yeah. Well said. You know, and one of the things I've been dying to ask you is, I know how hard you write with your material. I know how much time you put into it. I mean, I have a feeling, I don't know, but I've heard you say the amount of time it's a heavy endeavor. But, you know, then the topic of, like, joke thieves, and I'm not going to mention the one I'm thinking about, but she clearly has a lot of jokes that are very similar to what other comedians have said. How big of a topic is that in the stand-up world, Dan, as far as because of the time you put in, right? Because that's your work. That's your stuff. Like, if for somebody to just kind of lift it, you know, it's kind of is that a big topic, or is that just exaggerated at times by other people?
I mean, it happens, and part of it, I'm going to give the benefit of doubt to people that it's just parallel thinking and you're just thinking in a similar way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know how those people sleep at night, but I remember Jay Leno said something along the lines of, like, your job is not to go chase the people who take your jokes, because that's just going to happen. Your job is just to keep writing new stuff.
Right.
And I think that's a much more interesting take on that, because it's, like, so easy for us to just be like, no, that's mine. It's like, and just, like, get, like, there was one moment when I was starting out where I had a joke, and a guy who became a buddy of mine had a similar joke, and I got so offended, and I was like, hey, man, you came here from Philly. I've been in New York for all this time. I've been doing that joke. Everyone knows me for doing that joke. Like, don't do that joke. And he was like, all right, man, I won't do that joke.
Yeah.
And I felt like such an idiot, because he was just like, fine, dude, I won't do the joke, don't worry. Like, right. I didn't get it from you. I'm from Philly, and I'll just think of new stuff. And that to me was, like, so much more, like, humbling, because it was like, oh yeah, I guess it's not that big of a deal if you can keep writing new stuff.
Right. You know? Right. Yeah, that's so, a good
Joe DeRosa. Joe DeRosa, thank you for that lesson, if you're listening.
You know, you did write, you were at the Gene Simmons, I love those roasts with Jeff Ross, he's a genius. You wrote the Gene Simmons one, rest in peace, Ralphie May. Those are a lot of fun. I mean, essentially you're taking people that are not in the comedic world or usually have good stand-up, and you're making them that person, right, with your jokes and your material. How difficult is it, Dan, to write a roast and to really think outside the box? Because I feel like whether it's the Trump roast or the Gene Simmons, I mean, whatever, they're really creative and really funny. I mean, I know when I'm watching Anthony Jeselnik, I'm watching just a master at his craft. I know when I'm watching you, I'm watching a master at his craft. When I'm watching Martha Stewart go up there and rattle off some lines, I know this is not her work, right? So how tough is that, Dan, on your end?
Writing for roast is very exhilarating, because there's always, like, a really quick turnaround. You got to get it all together really quickly. And if I'm doing the roasting on something, it's easy because it's like my own words and whatnot. Right. Where it gets really tricky is when you're writing for other people, right?
Right.
Because you have to factor for, okay, Martha Stewart's not a comedian, so she can't deliver like a comedian. So you've got to make the delivery really easy. Or like in that Gene Simmons roast, I had to write a bunch of stuff for his wife.
Oh,
and
boy,
she was like, okay, I don't want to talk about sex. I don't want to talk about women he's had sex with. I don't want to talk about his tongue. I don't want to talk about Kiss necessarily. I don't want to. I was like, what the fuck am I going to write for this person? So, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that sounds really fun. And then when you're in it, you're like, whoa, this is a lot harder than I thought it was going to be, because customizing the jokes for other people. And then, like, also there's something really, like, bruising to your ego when you're, like, pitching jokes to someone like Gene Simmons' wife who's never been on stage and knows nothing about comedy. And they're like, no, that's not funny. I'm like, bitch, what do you do for a living?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, that's a killer, man, because it's like, you know what works. It's like, stop, just stop and listen. Like, come on, you know.
But I will say roast writing is a very, it's very cool in that it's like, talk about not getting too attached to a joke, because the amount of jokes that you write in that versus the amount that get used, that ratio must be so much higher in roast writing than in any other medium. I mean, you're going out there with like thousands of jokes and they use like 50.
Wow.
So it's like, it's wild. Like, and which is cool, because then you just, it exercises that muscle of not getting too attached to something that you love, you know, like killing your babies, we call it, like in writing.
Yeah. Like, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
you know, something that you just really, really love and you just have to let it go. Like, And Jeff Ross is like such a master at like managing those rooms too, though. He's like, he's become a friend of mine, and he's just like, it's so strange to me that he's made his mark by just like eviscerating people and making fun of them, because I truly, and I know people say this about other people, but I truly don't think there's a nicer person in the comedy business than Jeff Ross.
Yeah.
He's just the nicest person. And it's so weird that his whole career is just being an asshole to people.
It's funny you say that too, Dan, because when Bob Saget passed away, I can't remember who was with Jeff Ross, but they drove Bob Saget's car.
Yeah, John Mayer.
That's it. Yeah. But like, that's the sweetness that you're talking about. This is who the guy is. So yeah, so what you're saying makes a lot of sense. For those listening, you had two appearances on the late night, the Jay Leno show. When you landed those, were you beside yourself? Were you like, Jesus? I mean, because at the time, Leno is enormous. This is huge. Yeah. I mean, this is what all comics kind of strive for. I mean, whether it's Leno or Letterman, just talk about that a little bit, Dan.
Yeah, that, you know, so after doing stand-up for like 10 years, I did the Montreal Comedy Festival, which is like kind of a coming out party for comics. Like, it's where the industry sees you for the first time. And this was kind of before, like, you know, everyone, it was kind of before YouTube, before anyone could just put up their own stuff.
Right.
So this was the place like where you got to meet the gatekeepers.
Right.
And the bookers, Bob and Ross, who were the bookers for The Tonight Show, were in the crowd, and they basically right after were just like, we want you to be on The Tonight Show. And I was like, holy shit. Like, I couldn't believe it. And so I went to LA and I did The Tonight Show, and my manager was like, you got to move to LA now. And I moved to LA, and it's funny, cause I was, after the Montreal Comedy Festival, I was meeting with all these network executives. Like, you make the rounds with the network execs, and they're all just like, you know, stroking your ego. And they're like, you're going to be the next Seinfeld. You're like, you know, and this was like kind of after 9/11, it was 10 years after 9/11, but they were still looking for like a breakout kind of Middle Eastern, you know, person who could be like mass appeal. Right. And it was like, they're like, you're going to be Seinfeld, this and that. I'm like, cool. And then I got an audition for a role. My manager was like, we finally got an audition for you. I'm like, awesome. He's like, it's for a show on the Disney Channel. And I was like, oh, no, I don't want to do Disney. And he's like, no, but you got to do it. It's going to be good. This is how you meet casting directors. Just go on these auditions. I'm like, all right, cool. And I get the sides for the audition, and it's for a character named Falafel Phil. And you got to understand, like, I've never done like Middle Eastern theme anything. Like, a lot of Middle Eastern comics do that stuff, and I'm not hating on it, but it's never been my thing. Like, my thing has always been like, I don't want to be a Persian comedian. I want to be a comedian who happens to be Persian. So suddenly I have to play Falafel Phil, and it's with an accent and all this stuff. And I go to the audition and I, you know, do it. I meet the casting director. I leave and I get into my car and my manager was like, congrats, you got the job. And I was like, no, but you said I don't have to take this job. Like, you said it's just to meet the casting director. And he was like, well, now it would be really messed up to the producers if you didn't go and do one episode. Just go do one episode. So I go to do one episode and it's really hacky and like this super crazy hacky character who talks like this. My name is Falafel Phil and he has a goat who works in the kitchen of the falafel restaurant. And I do the episode and he's like, my manager later is like, you killed it, man. They want to make you a part of the show. And I was like, I don't want to be a part of the show. And I kind of got handcuffed into being Falafel Phil. And Falafel Phil ended up becoming the breakout star of this show. And at the same time, Aziz Ansari ended up being Aziz Ansari. And I really felt like that was a moment where they were like, industry was looking for someone.
Yeah.
And it was like, and I love Aziz. You know, we came up together. But it was like funny because like when Aziz and I were coming up at the clubs in New York, like they would confuse the two of us. They'd be like, is Aziz up or is Dan up? You know? So it was almost like we were kind of neck and neck and then Falafel Phil and then boom, he exploded. And it was like this interesting kind of sliding doors moment.
Yeah. You know what? If that was my position, I was, because I'm half Polish, that would be like somebody making a part for me, like Pierogi Pete or Kielbasa Karl. Like, do you feel like, at any time,
I'd watch Kielbasa Karl. Actually, I think that wouldn't get canceled as much as Falafel Phil would these days.
Oh my God! And for those listening, you are of Persian and Jewish descent, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's like, at the time, are you like? I mean, because I've heard you say, I mean, it's clear, it's not full blown racism, but it certainly has touches of it on. Right? Is it the best way to describe it?
I mean, I don't know that it's racism. It's probably more just like hyper extreme ignorance.
That's right. Okay, that's a better,
you know?
It's probably
like extremely ignorant. And it's funny because it's like this double-edged sword of like, I would see kids and kids loved this character and I got so much joy out of making kids happy from it.
Yeah,
like we go to like cancer hospitals and these little kids would just like lose their minds when they'd see me and it was so nice. But then at the same time, like, you know, white kids would come up to me and start doing this like fucked up Middle Eastern accent. Oh, and I was like, oh my God, what am I'm like infecting this generation of kids with an awful stereotype. But the silver lining is a lot of kids told me that they never even knew what falafel was and they tried it because of me. So, you know, that's a win.
Well, Kickin' It was a really popular show. I mean, kids loved it, right?
Yeah, Kickin' It was insane about it.
You know, and I wanted to ask you about, you know, the Jay Leno part, the Jay Leno thing. This will be the last stand-up comedy question I have. You know, the Letterman and Conan kind of like, there was a big thing with those guys and how they felt about Leno. And I think Letterman at one point said, like, this is the real Jay Leno. I don't know what everybody's like. This is what we've always known about him.
Right.
What is your own personal take on Jay Leno? I mean, obviously he has you on twice, so that's a huge act of kindness, right? So
yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because like I always try to be very authentic about my experience with someone because I think it's very easy to be like, that guy's a dick. Like you don't know how many times people have come up to me and be like, oh, Dane Cook, you work with Dane Cook at the Laugh Factory, is he like an asshole? And I'm like, honestly, Dane Cook has been nothing but a gentleman and very nice to me. Right. So I don't have a bad thing I can say about him.
Right.
But it's like very fun to jump on that bandwagon and be like, oh, yeah, he's such a dick. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
So in the same vein, Jay Leno's never done anything bad to me. He was always great to me. He gave me a platform. The guy is like the epitome of just like a hard worker. His work ethic to me is just like something to behold. I mean, the guy is working. I'll do like I'll perform on the weekends and be like, I'm gonna take the week off because I did two shows. This guy would do five shows a week of his Tonight Show, and then he'd go to Vegas over the weekend and do stand up.
That's crazy. Yeah,
I mean, it's just insane. Like, I have like an insane work ethic. I mean, look, he had a formula. He knew how to do his show. In terms of, you know, the late night wars, I'll let the 100 millionaires fight that out. I'm staying out of that. I don't need to be a part of their fight.
Yeah.
But he was, you know, nothing but but a gentleman to me and super generous. Yeah.
Dan, where did your paths cross with Tim Baltz? Is that his last name? He's on in Righteous Gemstones. What show? I'm like, I know they have a connection. I could not figure it out. What's the connection you guys have?
So Tim Baltz and I were on a show called Bajillion Dollar Properties.
Okay. Yeah.
This was a show on CISO, which was a very, very short-lived NBC comedy streaming platform they tried to do, which didn't end up working. But yeah, I always say that's the best show that no one's ever watched because it was on CISO, but it was just this wonderful, it was called Bajillion Dollar Properties. It was a sort of a parody show on Million Dollar Listing, and it was completely, or it was more than semi improvised, and just amazing actors. I mean, everyone on that show was insane. It was like Drew Tarver, who's, you know, the other two, he was on it. Paul F. Tompkins was in it. Ryan Gall, who's in The Last OG, was in it. I mean, Tawny Newsome, like everyone from that show went on to do amazing things. I mean, I have no excuse for not having moved forward since then, but maybe one day.
Stop it. Stop. Yeah, cut that out right now, because you've moved forward. And I guess my point is, you've worked some real, Tim Baltz is so talented, and you worked with Freddie Strom and some really other great people in the crew, a really underrated show.
Yeah.
So you've done some really great things with some really great people, you know?
Yeah. By the way, Kevin James, another one of those people that everyone wants to talk shit about. And I'm like, he was the nicest guy to me. He let me open for him. He was one of the funniest people I've ever worked with. And he was just like, he was a genius at multicam comedy. Like, you saw that. Why? You see these people who become super famous, and you see them work, and you're like, oh, okay, I get why you're super famous.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And people see the outside stuff. You're right. They kind of have that mob mentality, you know, oh, Kevin James is this, or Dane Cook is that. And they're not creative enough to kind of make their own thoughts. So they go with the mob mentality, you know?
Yes. And I also feel like, in a weird, like, psychopathy, like, people feel better about themselves when they can knock down someone who's done a lot better than they have.
Damn straight, Dan. That's absolutely, you know? Well said. Dan, before I get into Cobra Kai, I did want to talk about your freaking great podcast that I absolutely love, Green Eggs and Dan. I was looking at your Instagram today, and I listened to a few episodes yesterday. I just love the premise, right? The premise for those listening is basically have people take a picture of the refrigerator, and you talk about the contents. Dan, I want to tell you, I was looking at Alonzo Bowden's refrigerator. Bowden's refrigerator and Courtney Hengler's refrigerated. And yeah. I feel like a bigger fat ass than I already am. I'm like, they have nothing in there. And I feel like such a goddamn pig, like, my God. And Dan, who were to guess that Eric Andre would have the most normal looking refrigerator of anybody you interviewed? I was expecting like crossbones and skulls in there. And like, you know, it's like, he's got the most normal looking refrigerator.
Yeah. It's very, very true. I mean, look, it's funny. I've always had this obsession with looking at people's fridges when I go to their house, because it's kind of like looking in someone's underwear drawer.
Yeah.
Like, it's very voyeuristic. And yes, it's amazing. First of all, like, I love pulling the veneer off of people who, you know, Eric Andre is the opposite. Like, where someone that you think is going to have a disgusting fridge has a clean one. I love when people that you think are going to have a pristine fridge have like a disgusting one, or like a really lame one. And I put Courtney Hengler in that position. And
yeah.
And Courtney, who plays Mrs. LaRusso, on Cobra Kai, she's become like one of my better friends off of the show. But she's just like, she's so like elegant and poised and classy and funny and everything. And her fridge looks like she's a fucking college student who like ran out of money and like, you know, is desperately trying to steal food from the back of a restaurant that they're throwing out. Which to me was so funny. But yeah, I mean, it's always been a funny jump off point of using these fridges as a way to talk to celebrities. I mean, Alonzo's fridge was empty because he's on the road all the time.
See, that makes sense. Yeah. That makes, I get that. Some of the other comedians you had on the show had kind of the same situation. Why keep food if it's going to, you know, you're never going to be home. Well, yeah. So that makes sense.
You know? Eric Andre is like a sleeper, huge foodie. I think his girlfriend is a chef, and like he like has gotten big into making artisanal cocktails and like So he has all these weird ingredients. Like he's got like, oh, these are baby kiwis from my baby kiwi martinis that I make. You know, he's got all these random things.
Jesus. You know, and who is on your show, who's caught you the most off guard, whether it's in a positive or a negative way? When you looked at the refrigerator, you had some great guests. Like Henry Winkler took a picture, at least of the side of the door.
Well, the Henry Winkler story is what I was going to say, which is probably the funniest thing that's happened. Of all the episodes that we've shot, which was, so the premise of the show is we start off with a picture of the inside of the celeb's fridge. We talk about the fridge. I make fun of it, whatever. And then it goes into an organic conversation about their relationship to food. So I get Henry Winkler on. He's got a new children's book he wants to promote. And I'm super excited to have him on because, you know, I was here. He's the nicest guy in the world. He's so great. And I love Barry and I love the Happy Days. Like, I've been a huge fan of his. So it's 5 minutes before we start recording and we still don't have a picture of his fridge. And I reach out to his assistant and I'm like, hey, you know, we're shooting in 5 minutes and we need, and normally we get the fridge like days before the pick.
Right, right.
And I'm like, we still don't have the picture of the fridge. And she's like, stand by. And now it's 2 minutes before recording. And she writes to me and she goes, just spoke to Henry. He's super excited to do the podcast. He will not be sending you a picture of his fridge, though. He doesn't feel comfortable doing that. So I write back and I'm like, that's the whole premise of the podcast, though. We need the fridge pick. Like, that's the only, you know, that's the main reason people tune in.
Yeah.
And then she started getting like all pissed at me. She's like, how dare you? Henry put this time aside for you. His time is so valuable. How could you not do this? I'm like, I want to interview him, but I need a picture of his fridge. And I was like, compromise. Can I get just like a picture of the door of his fridge? And she's like, stand by. And now it's like, you know, we should have started recording 5 minutes ago. And finally I get like this grainy picture of the inside of his fridge door. And I'm like, okay, great. Let's get started. So we start the interview. And you know, normally I'd like make fun of the guest and be like, oh, so you didn't want to show me a picture of your fridge. But he was so like, just wanted to brush off the part where we talk about the fridge and just get into the conversation about food.
Yeah.
Where, you know, which begs the question, what the fuck is in Henry Winkler's fridge? How many severed heads, Henry?
That would be a good show to follow. Kibasa Carl was what the hell is in Henry Winkler's
in
fridge?
Henry Winkler's fridge. Oh my god!
Yeah, I love the podcast, man. How do you decide what guests you want? So Dan, so my podcast, I get people that like move me. Like your work moves me. I love it. That's why it's so fun to have you and talk and all this great stuff. How do you decide who and what who not what who you want on your podcast?
You know, it's become where I'll only bring on a guest that I really, really want to talk to. If I don't know who they are, I just am a real big fan. Or if they're friends of mine and I know they're going to be great guests. I'll tell you what's interesting is who I try not to have on the podcast anymore is people who are in the food industry. Like chefs, I've had like famous chefs and like, they're just like not funny and they're not entertaining. And like, they don't know how to carry on a conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So like people will reach out to me all the time to have like, you know, to be on the, they're like, our guest is they've written 35 cookbooks that are New York Times bestsellers. And I'm like, I have zero interest in that.
Yeah.
But if it's like some weird little, like, you know, improv comic from the Groundlings, I'm like, bring him on, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, my point is not to nerd out about like the minutiae about food necessarily. It's more just about like having fun conversations about food because everyone has a relationship to food, even if their relationship to food is that they don't have a relationship to food. So,
that's right.
And I think it's way more fun and entertaining when you hear a comedian or a journalist or, you know, an actor just talking about food than like a chef. Who's just like getting really like pretentious about it or like in the weeds, or they usually have these low voices because they think what they're talking about is really intense. I'm like, dude, it's food. Like, relax.
Yeah, Jesus. Know? Yeah. I mean, you had one, and this will be the last thing I say, you had one guest that showed you, I think it was her kitchen sink, and like it was like a foot in the picture. I can't remember who it was, but like that's the guest you want to have, Dan, right?
Yeah, that's my friend Ginger Gonzaga, and she's an amazing actor and comedian. And Ginger is has the worst relationship to food out of anyone I know. She's missed a dietary restriction, this and that. But that was probably one of the more fun episodes because we have a rapport, and also just like her fridge was broken at the time. So she was putting all of her food in the sink with ice bags, which was hilarious.
But that's the person you want to talk to, right? So, yeah. I wanted to end the interview talking with Cobra Kai. And man, thank you for all this time. I really just love talking to you. Thank you for that.
No, of course. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You know, for those listening, obviously you are Anoush from Cobra Kai. But it's your, I want to say that it's kind of the connections you made early on that led to this role, right? One of the creators, I can't remember which one it was, where your relationship long ago kind of aided it along the way. Is that fair, Dan?
Yeah, I've actually known the three guys for about 20 years now. When I moved to LA, John Hurwitz and Hayden Schlossberg were also moving to LA.
Right.
They had just done Harold and Kumar. And we had a mutual friend that they both went to college with. And, you know, when you move to LA, it's always like you have no friends and you're like, anyone, if you know anyone in LA, like, let's set me up so I can make friends. And we became buds and they came to my stand-up shows and, you know, we became really, really close. And in a weird way, John Hurwitz's sister ended up marrying one of my best friends.
Wow.
So, we ended up, you know, and my best friend Matt and like I ended up doing stand up at his wedding, you know, emceeing the rehearsal dinner. So again, just like getting to know John and Hayden more in that. And John and Hayden have always been fans of my comedy career and very supportive of it. And then Josh Heald, when he moved to LA, also I think he went to Penn with those guys, and that same friend who connected us before was like, hey, I have another friend in town. And it was Josh, and he and I met and got along so well because Josh is fucking hilarious.
Yep.
And I was like, this is awesome. I'm single. You're single. We're going to be wingmen. This is going to be amazing. And like, of course, the next week he meets the girl, Debbie, who ends up becoming his wife. And there goes my wingman. But funny enough, Debbie, Josh Heald's wife, is like a distant cousin of mine.
Wow. So like
all these very strange interconnected things. And we never really worked with each other, but we all always just kind of followed each other's careers parallel, and we always, you know, supported each other. And they called me and they were like, dude, we finally have the right role for you. I'm like, what is it? And they were like, we're rebooting Cobra Kai. We're rebooting The Karate Kid. It's this thing called Cobra Kai. And we don't have a lot of money. It's going to be on YouTube. So like, you know, you might have to fly yourself to Atlanta. And, you know, I'm like, guys, and they're my homies. I'm like, I would do it for free for you. And
right.
I was like, let's do it. Let's go. And the funny thing is my last name of the show is Naruzi, which is Deb, Josh Heald's wife, my distant cousin, her given last name is Naruzi.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I went and did it for basically no money. The first season, which, you know, we shoot it in like a couple of weeks, and that was it. And I was like, thank you guys, that was so cool. I got to meet my childhood hero. I appreciate it. I did not think for a second that this was going to become what it's become. You know, that thing. I mean, dude, we were on YouTube. Like, no one was watching it. Like, we had to beg people to watch it. Like, I'd have to give people my YouTube premium password. It was like, it was crazy. And then
those that didn't have the password, Dan, were going to something else called RedTube.
We're going to RedTube. Well, that thing, before it was called YouTube Premium, it was called YouTube Red, and everyone thought it was RedTube.
Jesus.
Yeah, and I was like, everyone's like, Dan, did you guys hear Dan became a porn star?
A lot of confusion. Like, sorry, Dan. I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
No. It's all good. But yeah. It was that same experience that I had with Bajillion Dollar Properties, which is like, man, there's this amazing show out there that nobody's watching, and it's such a bummer. And you know, you feel so defeated when you're like, think of the first season of Cobra Kai, man. The whole first season, no one was watching it. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And there's a good chance that Netflix would have never picked it up and it would have just kind of died a slow death.
Yeah, yeah.
And Netflix jumped in and like overnight, I could just tell by my DMs on Instagram, like I started getting like fan mail from like Brazil and like people in like the mountains of Pakistan. Like, we love your show. Like just from all over the world. And I was like, what the hell is happening?
Yeah.
And yeah. It was just like really, really insane thing. Of course, it coincides with the pandemic. So it's this moment where I probably become the most famous I've ever been. And every time I go out, I have to put a mask on so no one can recognize me.
Oh, no. Yes.
Like, God damn it.
That's such a great point.
I still remember I was like going hiking because it was like one of the only things we could do back then. And there was this little kid hiking. And, you know, this was back when, like, we didn't know, like, if you can get COVID outside by touching stuff. You know, no one knew anything about it. And, like, we were wearing our masks while we were hiking. And this little kid walks past me. And he's wearing a Cobra Kai mask. And I go, hey, do you watch Cobra Kai? He's like, I love Cobra Kai. And I pulled my mask down. I was like, I'm a noosh. And he must have, this little kid is in the mountains in L.A. And suddenly, like, someone from Cobra Kai.
Oh, that is awesome. What a moment.
Cool. It was a very cool moment. But yeah, man, it's, you know, finally now we can take our masks off and I can get recognized. So yes, that is the best thing to come out of the vaccine is that I can finally get recognized.
Yes. You know, Dan, and I was slow to the show, not because of where it was playing. I was just worried because, like, I have no business being very protective of the show. I have nothing to do with it. But like, as far, I don't know, I think we're probably in a ballpark as far as same age. Like, I love these guys. I love 1984. I'm very protective of my shows. I'm like, there's no way that they're going to take this spinoff and make it work, right? So, like, I'll give you an example. Like, yesterday announced that they're coming out with a Goonies TV show. I'm like, there's no way in hell this is going to work. Like, there's right. just, you can't take a classic movie and then just, so they broke all the odds in that case with Cobra Kai. So it's yeah. like, it's just, you're right. Who would have guessed it would have become this amazing, amazing thing? And the fact that a part was written just for you, it's pretty freaking awesome, if you ask me.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it's pretty cool. And it's funny because I remember someone came after me on Twitter to try to get me canceled. And she was like, Cobra Kai, you couldn't get a South Asian actor to play Anoush. And, you know, like posted it on Twitter.
Yeah.
And I responded to her and I was like, hey, Brittany, thanks for trying to get me fired. First off, Anoush is actually a Persian name that came from King Anushiravan in the, you know, 5th century BC. And Nuruzi is a Persian Jewish last name. I am a Persian Jew. Persian Jews make up 0.00001% of the world's population. Are you happy now? Am I allowed to play this role?
That's such a great comeback.
And you know what her fucking response was? She was like, oh my God, I didn't think you'd respond to me. I'm a big fan. I'm like, oh, cool. So you think I'm just like this as an anonymous person, you can literally try to get me fired publicly. But then when you see that I'm a real human being, you're like, oh my God, I love your work.
Yeah. Yeah. What a sincere change of heart.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and it's amazing too, because the show itself is pretty damn diverse. I mean, I think it is. Like, I mean, I feel like they do a great job. Like, even like Johnny Lawrence, right? He is the modern day Archie Bunker, right? He's so offensive, right. but so freaking lovable. Like, no, you know,
it's great.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about your scene in a second here, but like, you know, I have to say, if my wife ever gave me a hall pass,
yeah,
it might be Bill Zabka. I'm not gonna lie to you. That's how much I love like these two. Like these two guys have like they changed so many lives. Like,
first of all, I think you might get a permanent hall pass because you called your wife your girlfriend. First of all,
I know. Hopefully, everyone thinks I'm talking about the same person. There's not three people.
Yeah.
you know, and you know. In the episode All In, right? That's season two. What a great break. I guess I'm being facetious. What a great opportunity, right? Because you're in this scene with Bill Zabka where he's at the dealership. He pretty much breaks your arm, then gives you a nice little shot to the ribs. What a wonderful moment for you, a lifelong fan, to just do that with a guy that you just have so much reverence for and love for, right?
I mean, it's a testament to Billy that I'm smiling ear to ear that he kicked my ass. Yes, it was like really a dream come true. And it's funny because when I went in to shoot that day, there was another person there who was wearing exactly the same clothes that I was wearing, the same suit, same height. I'm like, who's this? And they're like, this is your stunt double. And I was like, oh, no. I want to do this myself. I want to get my ass kicked. And they were like, well, do you have any martial arts training? And I was like, yeah, I'm a blue belt in jiu-jitsu. And they're like, oh, okay, cool. You can do it then. So I'm like, awesome. So Billy is throwing me up against the car and twisting my arm like to the break, like to the breaking point. Okay. Like literally to the point where it's about to break. And we shot this thing like 15 times. And on like the fourth try, I was like, God damn it. I wish I let that stunt double. This is a really bad judgment call.
You know, Dan, that first episode, Ace Degenerate, is maybe the best first episode of any show of all time. I mean, that first episode, I mean, when you look at Johnny Lawrence and he's in a Pontiac Firebird, he's watching Iron Eagle, you know, he's listening to nothing but A Good Time, Poison, and Head Games, and Alan Parsons Project, and they finally meet for the first time since like pretty much 84. It's such a monumental episode. Dude, I got to say, I think I've watched that one episode tons of times. And what a great opportunity that you're in it too, right? Like just what a wonderful moment. And you're in that moment. I mean, I know you know all this, but for those listening, when they first meet each other, you're right there with them, right? You're there saying, you know, this is the guy from, what a moment, Dan, for a lifelong fan, right?
It was such insanity. It was, so yeah, the scene is me and Brett Ernst,
yep,
Cousin Louie, are working at the dealership when Danny confronts Johnny for the first time.
Yeah.
And I remember because I had known Brett Ernst, but I hadn't, like, you know, we knew of each other from the stand-up scene, but we never actually met. And so that was our first time meeting too. And it was the first time that we're meeting, you know, Ralph Macchio and Billy Zabka. And I had this moment with Brett where, like, we didn't know each other. And I was like, dude, I'm about to fucking lose my mind right now. And he was like, me too, bro. I cannot believe this. Because it's, like, hard enough to, like, remember your lines, like, on set. Because there's, like, 50 people in the room watching. You know, there's cameras. There's, like, you got to get it right quick because there's, like, you got to get things done in a certain time. Like, there's a nervousness to getting your lines right. And then compound that with the fact that you're meeting your childhood heroes. And then compound that with the fact that it's the scene where they're meeting for the first time. So there's double the amount of people there watching. All the network executives are there to watch this moment. And I still remember it after we did the first take, like they called cut and the whole place like went into spontaneous applause. Like it was like you just felt, I mean, I'm getting goosebumps right now. Like you just felt this magic that was happening. And it was like, that was the first time where I think everyone was like, holy shit, this show might be like, this might be a game changer. Because that was the craziest thing I've ever witnessed, like, cinematically. Like, these two meeting for the first time. And the fact that they're, like, both, like, very, very, very good actors. Because, like, you know, you never know if someone was acting when they were 16, if they're going to be good when they're, like, 50 and 60.
Right.
Dude, these guys are, like, haven't skipped a beat. Anyway, so it was just, like, it was this magical, magical moment. And yeah, like Brett and I always say, like, we are like stamped in like Karate Kid history, like just from being in that scene.
Huge. And when you said when they hit cut, the place went apeshit, right?
Apeshit. Like spontaneous applause from everyone, from the grips to the, you know, to the background actors, to the writers, to the producers, to the network. Everyone was going nuts. It was just electric.
You know, and one of the things that I really think about with this show, because yesterday was Pat Morita's birthday. He would have been 90. Wow. I think about what he would have thought about this show. He would have absolutely loved it. He would have loved every second of this. This is his legacy. This is his show. I think the show is like, and I said this before, I think Johnny Lawrence is like Luke Skywalker because I feel like this is his story. I mean, that's just how I see it.
Yeah.
But I think Pat Morita would have loved the hell out of every minute of this show.
I mean, look. The bottom line is, like you were saying before, there were so many ways to fuck this show up.
Like, so many.
Minefield of ways to mess it up, to make it too cheesy, to make it, you know, too sentimental, to make it too, like, you know, I don't know, wink-winky, you know what I mean? And to the credit of the guys, you know, John, Josh, and Hayden.
Yeah.
They are such, first of all, extremely talented writers. Extremely talented writers.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they are the biggest fans of this show of anyone else out there. Like, right. They are ridiculous super fans. And you see it on their faces when they hang out with these guys that, you know, look, in Hollywood, there's sort of a pecking order, right? The creator is up top and the actors are down here, right?
Right.
And like, in this show, it seems like flipped. Like, these guys, like, the creators of the show are so pumped and excited that they get to work with their heroes that it's almost like you see them, especially like John Hurwitz is like the biggest, like, he's like a child. Like, when he's like always smiling, he's so excited to be on set with these people. Like, he's like a super fan who like made it past security and somehow gets to hang out with his heroes. And it's so great to watch because it's just like good vibes all around. Like, I've worked on so many shows where there's like toxicity, like someone's an asshole, and it just like, it's top down, like it affects everything. And here it's just the opposite. It's like the creators of the show can't believe how awesome this is and they're so excited. The actors on the show can't believe their luck that, you know, this thing has been resurrected and has taken over the world. And you feel that in every single level of the production. Like, everyone is just so stoked and happy to be there, you know?
But that's why it works, Dan, right? I think your point is that's why it works, is because these three guys, they just love what they're doing, and their love just oozes off these episodes, right?
Yes, and that feeling that you have of you feel protective about the Karate Kid, multiply that by a million. That's how they felt going into this, you know?
Wow.
Like, they imagine the pressure that, like, they could be the ones that messed this up. And I think that, and also, by the way, credit to Ralph Macchio. Ralph was telling me that, like, he was approached, like, every single year about, hey, let's do a Karate Kid reboot. Every year, every other year, they'd come up to him and say, like, we want to do this. And he would say no to all of them,
right?
Because he was so protective of it.
Right.
Not until, you know, what, how many years after the Karate Kid did Cobra Kai come out? What is it, 30?
At least. It's 84. So, yeah.
So imagine, it took 30 years for someone to come up to him and pitch him the right version and for him to go, okay, I'm down for this one. You know,
Jesus.
So it's just like there's so many moving parts that all just happen to come together, you know. And think about it, like the fact that they can get every single person that was in the movie to do the show now, like I don't think they've gotten a no yet.
Dan, even going one step further, so like it's the way they even integrate scenes from the 84 movie, or like behind me, you see the Karate Kid 3, like movies that people dismissed as just, okay. I mean, I love all the Karate Kids. I mean, I just, I do. But the way they took those characters and have brought them back, it's, dude, it's like freaking magical. Like, it's nothing short of amazing.
But they even take the things that people like roll their eyes at, like in Karate Kid 3, that like he's, what's his name, is like a psychopath. And then he even says, he's like, man, I was doing a lot of cocaine. I was out of my mind, you know, like just referential. So he's like, what was I? I was beating up a child. What was I doing? You know, like there's that really funny, like kind of self-awareness of the movies in a modern context, which I just
thought. Terry Silver. So let me ask you this last question. Are you up to date with what's going on? Are you caught up?
Even the show?
Cobra Kai, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, okay. I've been to the day it comes out.
All right, so I asked this of all my guests on Cobra Kai, and I feel like I get laughed at more often than not on this. So when it comes to the villains on the show, I feel like the LaRusso kids are the biggest heels and villains on the show. Sam and they are bullies, and I just think it's ironic because who their father is. Like,
right.
Do I have too much time on my hands, or am I onto something, Dan?
No, I think you're absolutely onto something. I think that the fact that Daniel LaRusso, who basically epitomizes, especially for our generation, someone getting bullied and overcoming that bullying.
Yes.
And his kids are just like cold-blooded bullies.
Cold-blooded bullies.
Oh, man, I still remember that scene where, I'm forgetting.
Tori threatens you too, right?
Tori threatens me too. Yeah. I'm gonna what does she say? I'm going to break you like a pencil.
Yeah, yeah. Convincingly, convincingly.
Yeah. But I still remember that scene where Jackson, what's his name on the show? Why am I forgetting his name? Not Jackson, Dallas.
Kenny.
Yeah, Kenny is watching. He's on whatever, Fortnite or whatever the game is. He's like flirting with her and he's so excited. And they show this LaRusso's kid that is just like catfishing him basically.
Yeah.
I was like, my heart sunk. I was like, oh, how could you do this to this poor kid?
And then he pays for it in the end because Kenny decides, you know what? Screw you, man. I'm going to take you out myself. But Sam is like, I mean, I'm not saying Tori's perfect. Her mom is bedridden. She's taking care of her brother, working a job as a teenager. And Sam is walking around like a diva who has no care in the world but to make this girl's life hell. I'm sorry. I'm not talking about Mary Miles. She's a great actor. I'm not saying her. but this character of Sam is the biggest bully on the show. Exclamation point, period, end of story. Right? I mean, it's got to be.
I mean, she was bullied at first, though. Isn't she initially bullied by...
But she is. No, I'm saying Tori's not perfect. I totally agree.
Yes.
But like you said, consider who their father is and how he would have... But now she's almost the aggressor. Now she's like not... It's not self-defense anymore. Now she's on offense, I feel.
Well,
like.
Look, those lines are blurred. Those lines get blurred. Yeah. Those lines are blurred in the Karate Kid movie, you know?
That's true.
That's what's so exciting about it. That's why this show, it's funny like how a grown-ass man can get like really emotionally invested in like kids bullying each other. Like, I don't give a shit about kids bullying each other. But the fact that I had like such an emotional response to like Kenny getting bullied, like, this show is like it's like Game of Thrones, man. It's like you never know whose side you want to be on. Like your loyalties keep switching. You know, there's a character for everyone, and it's just like you never know what is going to happen.
And getting back to the one scene that we're talking about, Ace Degenerate, the wonderful first episode where all four of you are discussing it, and LaRusso's talking about, you know, who won the tournament, and then Lawrence comes back at him. Yeah, you beat me with an illegal kick. Something people have been talking about forever. But
yeah,
Dan, thank you so much. Anything around? What's around the corner for you? Really a big fan of your projects. What do you want to throw out there?
Thank you very much for having me. Well, the next season of Cobra Kai comes out September 9th, I believe.
Yep.
You would know better than I.
Yep.
And so be on the lookout for that. I also host a show on the Food Network called Raid the Fridge, which you can watch on Discovery Plus now. Everything is streaming there. My podcast, Green Eggs and Dan, and my Instagram and Twitter are at StandUpDan.
Perfect. Dan, I hope you come back on down the road sometime. I really loved having you, and you're just such a great, personable human being. Thank you for that.
No, I appreciate it, man. You're a great interviewer, and I watched some of your stuff. I was like, oh, this guy knows what he's doing. All right, let's do this. So I appreciate you having me.
Health and happiness to you, Dan. Thank you so much.
You as well. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Derek Thomas and Monday Morning Critic Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, you can also connect with Monday Morning Critic on Instagram and Facebook, MDM Critic on Twitter, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are found. All episodes available, www.mmcpodcast.com.